Hello, welcome to episode number 225 of the Apolog Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. Today's podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp.com. Get affordable, private online counseling anytime, anywhere. You can talk with a licensed professional therapist online today by going to BetterHelp.com/Apolog. And you can start a 7-day free trial by entering the code word Apolog when you go to checkout. Free week. There you go. And let me know how it works out. That'd be good. Well, you don't have to. I mean, there's confidentiality agreements and all that good stuff. You don't need to tell me. Why am I asking? Thanks, everybody, for shopping on Amazon and supporting the show. You, too, can support the show by going to apolog.ca/Amazon or apolog.ca/USAmazon. You can go do the old-fashioned way by going to apolog.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. Locate your country, whether you're from Canada, USA, or the UK. Bookmark those links, and every time you shop on Amazon, use those links to shop and support the show. It costs you no extra money. I'd like to thank everybody for helping me out on Patreon. You too can become a patron by going to patreon.com/apolog. P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and Apolog is spelled A-P-O-L-O-G-U-E. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. You can buy a t-shirt by going to apolog.ca/shop and buy some music there for as well. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. Give it 5 stars, please. And like the show on Facebook, facebook.com/apologpod. And follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. SimonHead666. Today on the show is Mr. Daryl Herz. Daryl Herz is the co-founder of Indie Week, which happens in the fall up here in Toronto. He's also now the marketing manager for the Canadian side of CD Baby, which is the oldest independent, it's the oldest website that supports independent artists by giving them good rates on low deals. Should be in a CD Baby spot here. CD Baby, check it out. Anyways, here he is, Mr. Daryl Herz on the Apolog Podcast. Hey, man.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. It's been a couple of years, maybe, I think. A year and a half, 2 years?
I think about that, yeah. So it's always good to catch up with you.
Yeah, man. So what is going on with you?
Lots. Since we last talked, and new to this year, I've just been hired as the marketing development rep for Canada for CD Baby.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Super excited about it.
And CD Baby is that company that started before, like, it's sort of like a mail order. How does CD Baby work? It's sort of a low numbers CD manufacturing company for bands, independent bands. And
is that that's where it started.
Yeah.
Basically, the original owner, Derek Sivers, was selling his own CDs online. An artist asked him, could you sell mine too? So it was kind of like a consignment kind of basis to start. And then it got into manufacturing and warehousing of CDs, fulfillment. Now we're completely digital with the physical distribution still. Like there's still a warehouse in Portland. But it's much bigger. There's a bunch of tools like Show.co, Dashgo, AdRev, where it's basically artists can run their own business, marketing, revenue generation through advertising. Plus another real cool part on the pro level is actually going after song rights. So basically, if your song's played anywhere in the world, we'll get the revenue for you and distribute it.
Wow. It's very, very independent music minded too, right? So it's sort of taking care of the little guy.
Absolutely. It's completely about independent artists, which is where I fit in. Like when I was first hearing about this opportunity and looked at further into the company, everything that they do is for the independent artists. So it really fits in line with what I'm already doing.
Yeah. So I started a similar thing a couple of years ago. It didn't really take off, but it was sort of an idea of a one WordPress site would then turn into several WordPress sites that could be have the same idea where you can skin it the way you want and then anything that needs to get taken care of. For me, it seemed like if good ideas are good ideas, then good ideas will take off. Or right. you can spend a shit ton of money to try to make your good idea a better idea when you put more people behind it. So, you know, I was waiting for the sort of gradual grow. And if I would have invested maybe $20,000 into it, maybe it would get a little bit more off its feet and then start gaining momentum. Is that sort of like a, that's how businesses start, really?
Yeah, a lot of marketing at the start for sure. Mm-hmm. CD Baby, though, was pretty much like one of the first, if not the first, to give access for independent artists to sell their music online. Like, I remember actually talking to Derek a few times when he first started it off, because the only other option at that time was like iTunes. And you had to be on a label to even be considered for iTunes. Yeah. So this was the alternative to it at that time. And it's grown, like it's been organic for the most part, but it's pretty much the biggest independent distributor online in the world.
Yeah.
With over like around 900,000 artists being distributed.
And a good idea is a good idea. So when, you know, organic growth is the word I was looking for, is that if you can have time to let it sort of grow organically, there must be a cutoff between where it's kind of starting to make money, but you've lost so much money that it, you know what I mean? As starting a new business, you know, and you're an entrepreneur, you're an entrepreneur as well as like you've started things from scratch and made things right. into nice, fledged, like beautiful businesses. And to me, I have so much respect for that because it's sort of something that I wish, you know, it's always a good idea at first and then you get lucky and then it sort of, it just sort of feeds itself. When you started Indie Week, you must have done a lot of handshaking.
Oh yeah. Especially the first few years. Like, I mean, probably about the first 5-6 years, it was just a hobby mm-hmm. and wasn't really meant to go bigger than it was. Like, I think we were doing about 6 to 8 venues and I think it was 40 to 60 artists. Where like last year was like 24, 26 venues with over 230 artists. but at the start it was, you know, being in Toronto, we already have a couple pretty big festivals. You know, talking to people, they're like, why do we need another? And it was literally, I'm like, we have a lot of great talent that's independent and emerging that is being overlooked by a lot of festivals. And we're missing out. And so I just wanted to give a platform for artists to be able to play in front of industry and also to get an education on the business. So, but yeah, the first 5-6 years, you know, going to sponsors was really tough because they're like, we already sponsor another festival. Yeah. You know, trying to describe it to people, they were like, oh, so you're like Canadian Music Week. And I was like, no. Oh, so then you're like North By. No. So it was a lot of defining who we are and what we are. And you know, it's a long, hard road when you're dealing with artists that nobody know about. It's about discovering them. So it took a long time to really kind of gain some steam and momentum. And, you know, we're at a really good place right now. But took a while for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the dawn of festivals now, like certain festivals are really struggling. Like Pussyfest has been struggling for years and they kind of do the similar idea where it's more punk rock based than independent music, because independent music is a blanket rather than they sort of niche themselves into punk rock and stuff like that. But yeah, they, like, I've spoken to both owners of that and both of them saying, yeah, we're like living off we're living off nuts and bolts. We got barely anything to get this thing going, yet it still goes. And it's for passion and it's for to keep the actual industry in the know that there is bands that are coming up and there is bands that are have a right to a voice. And in this world where everything is all at you at once online, it's somewhat soothing to know that as an independent artist that there's somewhere to go to actually play.
Yeah. And by no means like we're hugely wealthy or anything. We're still, you know, knocking doors for sponsors and funding and all that stuff every year. So,
but why are you drinking out of a gold coffee cup? I just saw you take it. It was like it was shining.
Oh yeah, the one that peels the flakes off of it. Yeah,
that's right. Well, I got my Groot cup. I got it from Disneyland. See that, baby?
That looks awesome.
It's pretty cool. It's the size of my head, actually. When you do that, hello.
Oh, that's true.
So yeah, so you know, I've known you for a while, but we've also like in and out of the business where we've worked with similar people and sort of like kept going. And I've always had an appreciation of what you and Cam Carpenter do with that. And it's a thing that when you become older as an adult, it's tough to maintain like those values. It's tough because we have houses, we have mortgages, and I always have respect for the people who sort of stick their neck on the line. Because when push comes to shove, I don't know if I'd be that guy.
It's tough for sure. You know, it's tough on family. It's tough on relationships, like the music business, and definitely festival business is pretty unforgiving. Mm-hmm. Like it's long hours, many days. At times that you're traveling to other festivals, and it's funny, a lot of people are like, oh, you get to travel. I'm like, I haven't had a day off for 20 days. Mm-hmm. You know, like I am traveling, but that's not a day off, you know, like I'm rushing around, you know, and I just did a pretty big stint. Like, when I got hired for CD Baby, I went to head office in Portland for some training. Then from there I went to Montreal for Folk Alliance. I was back for a week. Then I went to New York for New Colossus Festival, and then straight from there to Austin for South By. So, you know, I've been on the job for 6 weeks, but four of them I've been not home. Right.
Yeah.
And without days off, because usually your day off is when you're traveling. So
of course, and being sort of in that, you have to be accessible too, as a person that everybody needs an answer sometime or another. And I mean, you're living by your cell phone, you're living by your laptop, and if one of those two things fail, then you're kind of like struggling and in the loop. But you know, maybe once a year you should just sort of have it accidentally fall in the toilet, and you're like, I can't make phone calls today. I'm done.
Oh, it's usually December, January. I like this last year. I was fortunate. I took off. I went to Morocco for a week, and then New Year's I spent in New Orleans. So no complaints. It's the balance, you know, knowing when you can take the time, and the rest of the year you're just putting the pedal to the metal.
Yeah. Well, in my business, the toughest time to advance a show is like for the show that's on like January 12th, because you're trying like in the early December to contact people who are in the music business to advance the show. And they're like, well, I'm away December, because everybody knows that life shuts down in the music industry in December. It's gone. Like people do nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've kind of also scheduled it where like I've got a no book zone, meaning like I tried to not book any shows until March, April, as well. So right now it's like our planning phase for the festival, our sponsorship funding phase as well. So there's you know, we're on the other side of the year from our festival, but this is the busiest time for us, mm-hmm. you know, getting everything ready.
Of course, yeah, because it takes an incredible amount of preparation, and the importance is in the details, because there's always going to be like a little like, whoops, didn't get that, missed that, or I will try to get that better next year. This is in my business too, but the smaller mistakes you make shouldn't turn into like huge colossal fuck ups, because that happens. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure you've been aware of that, where it's like, I thought you were bringing the drum kit. Well, I thought you were bringing the drum kit. Well, now we don't have a drum kit. Like, that's happened.
Yeah. I always tell my staff and volunteers, you know, trust nothing unless mm-hmm. you've double, triple checked. You know, we've had where venues haven't opened their doors on time because the bartender didn't show up. we've had, where there's no power outlets or not enough power outlets for an event. We've had the craziest story, I'd say, is this happened 2 years ago. And on our first day, like everything's great. The sun is shining, the best weather we've had in weeks. I'm on my way to the bank because I have to pick up all the cash deposits for all the floats. And you know, when it's about 20 bars, it's a fair amount, mm-hmm. and you have to order a week ahead, so that like you can't just show up and say, hey, I need, you know, 20 floats. And on the way there, I call my production guys and I'm like, everything's good. Yep. You're meeting the drivers, picking up the vans to go pick up all our backlines, which is also a lot of gear. I get to the bank and doors are locked and the lights are off. And the person there goes, oh, we were hit by lightning last night. So none of our electronics is working. And I'm like, but I need these floats. So they directed me to another branch that's, you know, about 6 blocks away. So right off the bat, my timeline is off because it's going to take longer. And plus this other bank won't know. On the way there, I get a call from my rental place where I pick up the vans. And they're like, are you the guy that needs the vans today? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, are you sure you need them today? Yes, absolutely. Today. In fact, there's probably about 4 drivers sitting out front waiting for our production guys to get there. And he's like, because the big cube got in an accident.
The big cube.
Yeah. And the 2 vans that were with it are witnesses and they can't leave. So within 20 minutes, my whole day completely changed.
God himself. He looked upon you from heaven and went, no, not today, Daryl. Not today.
Yeah. What? You know, so I had to call my production guys and go, well, the last 20 minutes, everything has changed. We are now probably about 2 hours behind schedule. And then when they went to pick up the gear, they dropped it off and found that the rental company just forgot to put 20 mics in the bag.
So, oh my God, what a day. It makes you think, oh, you know what? Next year's maybe probably not going to happen.
Those thoughts do cross your mind in the middle of it. Yes, it's crazy, you know, and it's all like those are things that are completely out of your control. And it's our job to make the show go on, put on a face so people don't even know this is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with.
Yeah, because it does, everything does sort of resonate with itself. So if you're the top, the king that's sitting there going, oh my God, this sucks, everything's bad, then it's going to just flow downhill until the band shows up and then the production manager at the venue is like, you know what I mean? And then it turns into, oh, now everybody's in a bad mood. You know what I mean? So if you sort of sit there and put on that brave face and go, okay, yeah, I got this, then it shows that, first of all, there's a lot of faith in you to actually put out. And, you know, the other fact is that it does, like I said, it all bounces off each other and then the vibes are good. You know, if you can believe in that.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest, sometimes it's pretty tough. Yeah. Sometimes it's pretty tough, but we make it through and we always get good feedback and everybody's had a great time. So that's what it's all about.
Yeah. My favorite story with when it comes to having to put on a brave face is Kevin Lyman. Just him on his own dealing with Warped Tour when it was sort of like in its crazy heyday when there was no real organization. There wasn't even water, you know. So you're like, he's just sitting there and he's just like, yeah, we got this, no problem. You know, and he's just gritting his teeth and like a truck didn't make it across the border, which was the other stage. Like everything was gone wrong and he just sort of just hung on there, you know, and that must take a toll on you with this just physically like, oh my God, this is just, you know, the stress alone is, you know, how do you cope? Do you meditate?
I just sort of go into auto mode almost and just, it has to get done. And it does build character, as they say, you know. I've in the music biz, I've been in a band on the road where in a car on fire. Mm-hmm. So I actually have a saying, you know, if something's going wrong, I'm like, is the car on fire? No, well, we're okay then. But through the years, like when we were doing stuff in Ireland, I've dealt with the Iceland volcano going off. And,
oh, yeah, me too.
We were stranded in Ireland for 7 days, which I actually was okay with.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
We had a flood in Dublin where you couldn't go from the north and south sides of the rivers. So we had venues on both sides, but it was hard to get across. The Queen showed up one day in Ireland and all the streets were closed off. And again, people couldn't get to certain venues, security checks and all that. And so we've had the range of stuff, you know, and it's actually getting easier because it's just, oh, it's not as bad as 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I got stuck here for the Iceland volcano, and I was supposed to go to Europe and play shows with my band, and it was looking like it was going to happen. That wasn't going to happen, and I was the only one that had to fly over. The band was waiting for me in Italy. It was a band I put together in Italy, and we couldn't find flights. My flight was canceled. I was supposed to fly into Milan. Then I ended up sitting there going, that's it, we're done. Whole day goes by, and then I start looking online. And I start seeing flights opening up to, like, Rome. So I'm like, oh, I could fly to Rome and take a train up to Milan. So I'm sitting there and I'm talking to my mom on the phone going, I'm just sitting there going, I got the flight. So then it was like one of those moments where it's like, holy shit, that was almost like the whole, everything was finished. You know what I mean? The whole tour that we were doing was going to be bust and everything, to complete and utter, like, yes, this is going to work. And then, So I just flew to Rome, and then ended up the people in Milan bought the train ticket already. So there's this, like, 2 mile lineup because everybody had the same problems I did. I just jumped on the train and I was up in Milan and practicing, and we're on the road and played in Munich the next day. It was like one of those crazy, this is going to happen. It's going to happen, you know? And like you say, it takes a little bit of experience to sort of go, yeah, it could be much worse. There's a lot of coping skills you learn in this business to not, you know, completely throw in the towel when it's like, no, we still got a little bit of time to go. And sometimes that's to a fall, right?
Yeah. And I'd say, you know, it's it helps build a good skill of thinking on your feet and adjusting. There's some people that come into this business and, like, they'll plan stuff and they expect it to go just as planned. And they keep, there's times where they don't adjust. I've seen it where they try to keep running with the same plan, and I'm like, no, things have changed. We're not doing that anymore.
Yeah,
and we have to make a new plan right now. And you know, that's I've been talking to a lot of event organizers and other festivals. Like, we partner with a festival in Brazil. We're working with them for Montreal and other festivals, and we all go through the same stuff. We all have had, you know, near disaster, but no one knows it because it's behind the scenes and we put on a smile.
Yeah, for sure. And there's must be a nice little network, because it's the idea of multi-venued festivals is it's easier than doing a big 400,000 person rock festival, in my opinion. There's a lot of moving parts, but it's the rinse and repeat with the smaller venues. Like, what did you think is easier? Is it doing a big old, like, 100,000, 200,000 person rock festival, or like a multi-venued festival?
Logistically, the fewer the stages, the easier it is to actually just run, I would say. Like, the logistics of just getting 20 backlines up and running at the same time is quite a bit. However, the price tag on the big festivals is really huge. And I would say that in Ontario, they're having a hard time surviving, and many have canceled or gone away. I could name probably 10 festivals that just don't exist anymore, where they had big money behind them, they had big stars, but they just couldn't make a profit.
Did you ever see that documentary on Netflix, The Fyre Festival?
Absolutely.
Did it make you smile?
it was crazy, you know, just to see you know, like, there was that moment where people are coming to the island and they're just sending them to a bar and feeding them tequila and thinking, okay, cool. But they're not going to notice that accommodations are ready or anything, you know, like, we're just going to get them drunk.
Yeah.
that was quite the thing to see and watch it go down.
Well, I mean, as a promoter of sorts, you know, when you see that, you're like, okay, that's the wrong type of person to deal in that situation. And I actually heard on another interview with Travis Barker, Blink-182 was saying, like, we weren't going to go anyways. Like, I wasn't going to, because he doesn't fly anymore because of his plane crash. He's like, right. I'm not taking a train to Florida and then getting on a boat and going, like, blah, 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 blah. So they pulled out, not just because of it was sketch, but they pulled out because they were like, I'm not going. I'm not going to do that. So there's the one guy I recognize, the PA systems tech guy, and I don't know where I know him from. I think he's been to, I've seen him on shows, and you know, you could just tell, like, everybody's just getting, like, completely screwed over, you know, and just to go get water. I mean, let's leave it at that. Like, it's, like, unbelievable. And then, you know, yeah. The only people I really enjoyed watching was, like, the local people who live there. You know,
right.
Just that, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it does give you, it gives you insight as to what can really go wrong when you start fooling people. Like, you just get caught in this weird trap and this weird lie. It's only going to be, like, the worst thing ever for people.
Yeah, and it's funny because we always go through, like, these brainstorm sessions at the start of the year, like, hey, what are some new ideas that we should try this year? Mm-hmm. And some people bring some stuff up and you know, they get a kick out of me because a lot of times I'm like, no. I'll just be like, is when you're planning this, I feel you have to look at the end result and work your way back.
Yeah.
And when you're thinking of it, a lot of times people will brainstorm thinking of, oh, well, this will be all good and great, but they don't realize all the work that's going to take to put something on. So when I'm thinking ideas or brainstorming, I think, what's the end result? And I work myself back. And if there's too many moving parts, too many steps, or a lot of things that the budget could creep really easily, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of times I say no to things, you know, just because there's a lot of times I'll go, well, did that in 2008, didn't work.
Yeah.
Did that one in 2010, didn't work. So,
right.
So by doing it for a long time, like, this is, I think, our 17th year, we've tried a lot and we've seen a lot of things not work. So that's hopefully where experience comes into play and you get better as you go.
Yeah. What I've noticed too is because I'm sort of in the supervisorial position too. And when someone says, let's do that, and you say no, it sometimes comes off as like, he's just saying no to say no. But there's like several things in my mind that say no. And do I have to explain all 20 of them? And the answer
exactly.
is, no, I don't need to explain all 20. This is the reason why we're doing it. And if you want to have a sit down and have a coffee or a beer, I will give you all 20 reasons why. But then it sounds like you're sort of browbeating them when you're like, no is a much better way. It's a Band-Aid and it rips off, but no is just one of those things that just, it sticks. You have to say, that's not happening. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I totally agree with exactly what you're saying. And I found in the past where I would do no and try to explain blah, blah, blah. And then 20 minutes would go by and we're still not doing it.
Yeah.
So all it is 20 minutes was wasted instead of talking about more new ideas and trying to find what we are going to do.
Yeah.
So I don't have the luxury of that kind of time. So I'm pretty black and white and to the point.
Yeah. But only, you know, the architecture of this setup. So if somebody triggers an idea that you know works based on a similar thing you've set up, and you can use a template of sort where you said, well, that's a good idea because that will feed off that. And then two reasons rather than one reason becomes apparent. So that's always like an interesting concept because that's why, you know, people like the person who's my boss and you being the boss of your thing, it's sort of they can sort of piece together things. And they don't need to explain to me, my bosses need to explain to me the big picture. Well, my part is a certain little part of it. And his understanding what the big picture is far exceeds what my great ideas are, because they're not great ideas if they don't fit into his big plan.
Yeah. And all the times, like when I do have to sort of explain more, I didn't really think of it that way.
Yeah.
That's my point.
That's because that's what makes you that in your position and the other person in their position. So, and then sharing those ideas, I'm not saying, you know, I think I was coming off a little harsh because if you say no, you say no, and you say, well, here's the reason why, then they'll go, okay, then they think kind of like you. And that's sort of what needs to happen in a pyramid of power where that one message needs to filter all the way down to that person sitting with a clipboard at the venue that says, what's your name? What do you need? The big message always needs to filter through. I'm a big advocate of that where I work.
Well, the other thing too is sometimes just saying no kind of means it's not a discussion anymore. because sometimes people will try to go justify it, but it's still a no. So like, I don't mean to be a jerk about it, but it's just like, we don't have a lot of time if we're not doing it. So,
yeah. You know, like the ones that sort of go, And then if you see, the other thing too is if you sort of say, well, I don't think that's a good idea because X, Y, and Z, then they'll try, well, what about W and Q and S and then this and that? You're like, that's when, for me, I go, okay, no, just no, no.
Exactly.
Because that's if they don't respect the fact that you've come up with the no for, not just based on the fact of saying no, there's several things in play. That's tough to explain with one no, but there's reasons why you've said no. And if you have to explain all reasons, then you've sort of shown a weakness to them that they can exploit. Does that make sense? Yeah. Where they can go, but if we tried this other angle, but then what you said before, no is no, man, that's not going to happen.
That's it. Exactly. You know, and it's you know, also where I think experience comes in is also going to other festivals. I go to a lot of festivals in a year and I see what's working for them and what's not working for them from the outside. And, you know, that's where ideas come about as well, as just by attending other festivals. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when people aren't on that circuit, they don't know the trends. Like there's a lot of, like I'll go to festivals and I'll go, oh, they're all doing kind of the same new thing.
Yeah.
You know, like big trend right now is health and wellness, being a part of the festival, you know, and we did that. I feel we did it first 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. We had a whole day dedicated to health and wellness and people were like, oh, well, that's odd, but cool. Mm-hmm. And now, I, you know, I just was at South By and they had massive amount of health and wellness being featured. Yeah. So it's talking about addiction, suicide prevention. There's also training for like venues and crew about, you know, I can't remember the name, the Naxalin, I think, or Noxalin. Mm. Basically, if somebody's having an overdose, there's kits at each venue that we can save people. And so there's a lot of that going on right now. Also, just being healthy on the road, like dietary and things like yoga, meditation. So it's a really hot topic right now. And, you know, I was really proud that we were pretty much the first festival to have anything to do with that. So
yeah, and it's I appreciate that because touring and being in a venue, like I had my very very small stint of being the house guy at a place called Ted's Wrecking Yard for like 2 months, 3 months, and it was like, yeah, this sucks. Like it really does. There's being the house guy at the venue. I really, when I go to a venue now, I'm always like, hey, you're the house guy at the venue, and I appreciate you because you put up with a lot of assholes and you have a tough time because your PA system isn't amazing and you wish you had an amazing PA and the owner won't give you enough money to buy new stuff and they just let you play on shitty gear all day. That's the part that sort of hurts, you know? So I go in and I always appreciate those guys because it's like, yeah, I was there for 3 months and I didn't want to ever do that. That's why I only did it for 3 months.
Yeah. Well, I've been a booker for various venues around the city and, you know, in my early days, I'd want to be there almost every night and, you know, everything's going smoothly and, you know, I was young, but, you know, people end up buying you drinks. You get some couple comps from the bar. You end up drinking like every night and it's not healthy, you know? So I know I went through a period where I was drinking too much and, you know, it is really easy for things to kind of go off the rails on a night. Even if it was a Wednesday, you know, often Wednesdays were like our Saturday, you know, so I don't book a venue per se anymore. I book events and stuff, but the saying is that we're throwing the party, we're not the party.
Yeah, and that's a tough line to divide when you're like 20 years ago kind of thing, because it's like, yeah, I'm always down to party when I'm 25. You know what I mean? Like, who isn't?
Yeah. And also, you know, I moved here not knowing anybody. So it's like, oh, the head booking agent's buying me a drink. Oh, we're building a relationship kind of so that I can call on him later. And then, you know, oh, the A&R rep is giving me drinks and things like that, where you also don't want to say no.
Yeah.
When those type of people are, you know, hey, do you want a drink? It's hard to go, no, I don't.
It's tough. Yeah. The opportunity is in the fact where if they buy you a drink, they're like, what's this person like? And how can this person help me? But at the same time, they're buying you a drink. So you have to sort of hear what they have to say. And that's networking. And that's the craziest part about this business is that it's the only real business that I know of, besides watching Mad Men, where you can actually drink on the job.
Yeah. And it revolves around it, you know. Yeah. Sponsorships are often liquor and, you know, like I was just at South By and there's afternoon barbecues everywhere. And you walk in, the first thing to do is give you drink tickets.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just part of the game. And I think, you know, after doing a long time, you know how to navigate it a bit better.
Yeah, that's true. Because then they appreciate the fact that when you get older, when you're getting your 40s, like I am or whatever, you go, hey, he's not taking drinks anymore. He must have a good head on his shoulders. You know?
Yeah. Drinking water.
It's a completely different story. Like, hey, look at that guy. He's not a drunk like me.
Yeah. Well, I took a young artist around to a festival, and, you know, it was like we're hitting 6 to 8 parties in the afternoon. It's all industry mixers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're like going full on every drink ticket that they can get. And I'm like, we got to go. And he's like, oh, but I just got this drink. Yeah, you didn't pay for it. Leave it.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's free. I'm like, yeah, we're going to a place that's going to have more free. So, and they'll just, you know, guzzle it. And by end of the day, they're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
By end of the day, I mean 6 p.m.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Oh, man. Yeah. To play that game too, because it's also, if you're 20 something years old in a band and people are buying you drinks all day long, it's tough to navigate, because the same idea as just being an industry person is you don't want to hurt people's feelings, you know, you want everything you do, it's so first impression-y, right? So if you're anybody, I mean, in this business, that if you somehow come off as just a hint, a sniff of asshole, you're the biggest asshole in the industry. And that's a tough thing to get back, you know, like.
Oh yeah. Well, it was funny, 'cause like when I was growing up, the bigger the ego, the better you were, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like there was a phase there where like Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue, and
yeah,
like that was crazy days. And then shortly after that, it was like, yeah, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting to see it change, you know. Yeah.
That's with Soundtex too. There was a cutoff point between like 1990 to 1992. Where the whole, everybody that wore the hip sack with the ponytail, those guys, and they were the biggest assholes ever. And I remember going into like the Helmet Combo, and the guys like were opening for the Doughboys, and the sound guys going like, opening act, no monitors. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Like, what did we do wrong? Yeah. And he called Al, and what do you call him? Al called him an out-of-work musician. Like, it just turned into this nose-to-nose situation. And then by, like, 2 years went by, and I think all those guys either got just quit or died, and then there was, like, a whole new breed of sound people. And I always sort of, like, I sort of came in at 92 sort of, like, as a professional sound guy, and it turned into, like, oh, it's a nice guy's business now. We're here to make nice, because it was a complete opposite to the people that we had worked with, like from the 80s to the 90s.
Funny, I found that went to the 2000s.
You probably escalated faster than me, though.
I found there's a lot of sound guys that, yeah, just wish they were on the road, not in a small bar.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I toured a lot with SNFU, and I could tell you in the first hello what type the night was going to be like with dealing with sound people. It's like, hey man, how you doing? And then it was either like, hey, how you doing? Or yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, it's gonna be one of them nights. So it was always like an us and them thing. But when you came to a club where it was like the guy was super nice and the gear was well maintained, you're like, oh my God, it's so few and far between to work with people who are like professional.
Yeah. Well, one thing I found that diffused a lot with sound guys, right, first impression, is I would walk up and say, here's our set list. Just let us know when you need us for anything. And, you know, if it ends up being a line check, we're okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of like, you know what we're playing, how long, and we're okay with whatever you need to do. And it kind of just made things easier in dealing with sound guys.
Yeah, well, I was touring with Good Riddance in the early 2000s, and I'm probably going to, and there was a guy in Florida who is a sticker on from like their early 90s era, because he only had two wedges, and Good Riddance are like, we need four mixes, there's four of us in the band, He says, well, right. I only bring the monitor system for international touring acts. And Chuck's like, we are an international touring act. We go all over the world. Where's our monitors? And it was very funny because Chuck had to put his teeth, like put his claws were out, right? He's like, come on, man. So like, and then the whole funny thing about that is we completely and utterly killed him with kindness. At the end of it all, I was like, yeah, man, that's cool. We can do it too. We can do it with none. And it was very funny because for me, not having to deal with, like, just looking at the PA system with, like, no drum mics and some vocals, and like, hey, my day's smooth. I only bring the monitors out for international touring acts. And we're in some weird community center in northern Florida. It's like, come on, dude.
Yeah. Well, that's touring life, you know?
Yeah. I always give the sound guys credit, whether we're playing in a larger venue or smaller venue, because I still play, but it's always good to sort of give recognition to the people that do the work, because it makes them try harder, you know what I mean? It makes them smile, you know, because they don't get a lot of love, you know what I mean? I'll tell you that firsthand, like, they don't get a lot of love, and they do, they're the first ones there, the last ones to leave. They're like, it's no, what's his name, who did that song, The Loadout? I can't remember anything today. Never mind.
Yeah.
You know where they sing Stay? Jackson Brown. It's the exact same as the Jackson Brown song. They're the first to arrive and the last to leave. There we go.
Yeah. Whenever I think of that, I think of the Roadie by Roadies by or the Road Crew by Motorhead.
No. Yeah. So. It's funny because they in that Jackson Brown song, he talks about working for minimum wage. I'm like, yeah, bullshit. Not
working minimum. You know, one thing I was going to say, though, about artists and all this is that, you know, and I've had some discussions recently, is just that, you know, when I was coming up through the system as a musician, there seemed to be a system in place where there is an ABC circuit, and you had you knew what you had to do to get to the next level. And I feel that doesn't exist for artists. So, you know, it's really sad to see, like, but they just don't know, and everybody's making it up, like, there's no, this is how to do it, and you know, by having limitations when I was growing up, or, you know, like when I first moved to Toronto, even there were 6 venues, that's it. So it is like I didn't have a choice of like 45 venues to play,
right?
Where you know, you're reinventing the wheel all the time. It was like, well, to get to the Horseshoe, you probably have had to play it somewhere else. Yeah. And that means there's only 5 places to play. And then you go, well, the 2 of them are acoustic, so now I'm only down to 3 places to play to build an audience and so forth. So, you know, like, I think education for artists is a really big thing. Mm-hmm. With the Indie Week front, we have our conference called Indie 101, and that's always been about educating artists. And with the CD Baby front, I'm really excited because everything that they do is for the artist, and they're about educating the artists. Like, we've got a DIY conference in Austin, Texas in August, and it's just for artists to learn. They've got a DIY blog, DIY podcast. Jumping on board with CD Baby was really easy because they're all the same about educating artists. And, you know, the stuff that we're talking about, it's like, you know, it's, we say like, well, I've got experience in festivals because I've been doing it a long time. I feel it takes a lot longer for artists to get experience because it's all over the place, that it takes them twice as long as it does now than it did before on how to just know how to do things. You know, I've dealt with artists where they're like, oh, I've paid my dues. We've been playing 6 years. I'm like, cool. How many tours have you been on? Well, we're working on that.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you haven't paid your dues. Like, wait till you do go on your first tour, you know?
Yeah.
And many of them don't. They don't even get on a tour.
Well, I was going to say that when you were talking about venues, and there was sort of it was the only thing you could do to make money. And it still kind of is for some acts. They still need to tour. Otherwise, they don't have any money in the bank. But they've developed the brand from touring. They didn't, you know what I mean? Like, so being a live act is a band, like, for instance, if Bad Religion decided tomorrow not to tour or play shows anymore, they'd all be in the unemployment line looking for, you know, handouts. But they have to play shows. But they came up in a time when that's all the only way you could do it, and that's how you sold records, and that's how you got people interested in you, is by touring. So I think there's been a shift in the industry where people can stay in their house, make a YouTube channel, stream live, and then make their money that way. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's different, because when you need to go out on tour and play shows to sort of push your brand, there's a few thoughts. One of it is like, we're doing it because that's what everybody else does, or we're going to do it and we're going to make an actual, we're going to make a happening out of this. This is going to be the occurrence that some YouTube sensation band from somewhere other than here is going to come to Toronto and they're going to play one night only. You know, and it's going to kind of be like maybe the 70s when Zeppelin rolled into town. It's like, holy fuck, Zeppelin's in town. This is amazing. There's nothing else to do tonight. And it might wake the industry up a little bit by doing things like that, using the internet to sort of be able to do like a one night only kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I see certain promoters are on the ball digitally, and they're using analytics and algorithms to drive fans to their niche shows.
Yeah.
Like there's, and it, you know, the sad part is organic discovery is almost dead.
Yeah.
Like,
cause there's too much, there's too much to organically look through.
Yeah. But I would look through the record store and I would discover, you know, like I remember I walking through once, just as an example, there was a really cool album cover and it was a band called Angel Fish. Mm-hmm. And I like, oh, I love this cover. I'm going to buy it. And later that turned it into the band Garbage.
Yeah.
So it was like when Garbage came out, I was like, oh, I already kind of know this band.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not happening because one, we don't have the street level record stores anymore.
Yeah.
So then the other thing is that we all have iTunes and Spotify, and there's algorithms and they're just pushing in our direction stuff that they think we already would like.
Yeah.
So we're not going outside of our circle and discovering just off the wall stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That was the thing about stumble upon.
Right.
Just stumble on stuff, and it's like it might be really dirty and creepy, but then you'd stumble on something like, "Oh, this looks neat," you know?
Yeah, but I mean the record store forced me like I would buy from the like there, I actually would go in and plus I worked at HMV for a number of years, mm-hmm. but I would go in and buy from the classical, the soundtrack, the jazz and blues sections, and then the alternative section.
Yeah.
And I literally would kind of like budget, well, I've got this much money, but I don't want to buy all rock albums. I want to buy diverse amount.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't think anyone's going online going through the classical blues soundtrack sections on Spotify as much as they would have if they just browsed by it in a record store. Yeah.
And I'm with you. I'm with you on that, because there was a certain sense of, because I go Value Village hunting for records, like when we'd be on tour. And there's nothing more satisfying than buying the weirdest album ever from Value Village that you know somebody probably played a million times.
Yeah.
And I think I know why people don't do that online, because there's a certain amount of trophyism. Like, I have this record. This record is Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, the record that everybody wants to hate, but it's the best album ever because I say, you know, and that's sort of that you can almost like champion something that's sort of like in many respects wouldn't be cool, you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. And back in the day, it was like music knowledge was like value, mm-hmm. you know, like we would be like, oh, well, let's hire that guy at the store because he knows a lot. And he'd be the one that customers would go to and ask, you know, what's new or what's coming out.
Yeah.
And it would be a person that would be a conversation about stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's you know, our algorithms send us stuff, and then what I see with concert promoters is the targeted advertising. They're able to sell out shows directly to their niche, and like I'll walk by the Velvet and there's a lineup down the block and I'm like, I don't know any of these artists that are playing at Velvet because mm-hmm. I'm not the demographic. I won't see the ads, I won't see anything. And so I actually don't have the chance to discover what's playing in our city because I'm older and I'm not that demographic, and I won't see any of the ads. You know, it's the same. Mod Club's packed all the time, and it's like I have no idea who these artists are.
Mm-hmm. And
you know,
yeah, it's an well. When you say that, I think that there are demographics in all of this, and To me, I see it as sort of like, that's somehow a little bit refreshing, because that means the torch has been passed, where there are younger people who are going to go out and line up to go see a band that I've never heard of. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm okay with that in a sense. The method of doing it is completely different than how we did it. We have to, you know, obviously you're an embracer of technology. You know, you have to sort of cope with what's going on with the business. But I think yearning for an older, for the older days, it worked then. And it, will it work now? Like, will getting on, in a van and traveling to Thunder Bay and playing Crocs and Rolls, if it's still open, for $20 and then going to Winnipeg, or maybe you might get a show in Dryden. You're lucky if, you know, and then touring across Canada. There's a reason why I don't do it anymore. It's because it fucking sucks. It's the worst. Like, it's horrible. Yeah. Unless you're in a tour bus where you can sleep overnight, which nobody can afford anyways. So no. I do appreciate that someone has figured out, smarter than me, has figured out how to monetize music, whether you're on the promoter side or on the band side. Somehow they've figured it out, and it's a sort of, that's natural evolution, right?
Yeah. Well, it's the thing I see is the majority don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I'll talk to them and go, hey, do you use a Facebook Pixel? And they're like, what's that? And right off the bat, like, that's kind of my open to the discussion, where if they go, I don't know that, that means they're not marketing the right way.
Yeah.
Right off the bat. But there's a band called Sumo Psycho that we had at Indie Week, and I talk about them a lot because I really admire them and they're doing great.
Matt was in that band called Dodger, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so there is validity to touring, but you don't necessarily have to tour your country. Tour Europe.
Oh yeah.
Tour places where it's like 2 hours to the next place, not eight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what they've been able to do, and I've seen others, is that, you know, if they're able to get 100 fans in 15 cities, then, you know, the next time a CD comes on sale, those fans are buying it online.
Mm-hmm.
So they're building an audience so that, like, they just put a new merchandise on sale. And, you know, in 24 hours, a number of items are sold out.
Yeah.
So I think there's a balance of live and online that artists need to still work out.
Mm-hmm.
Use the online to market so that fans are there by the time you get there.
Yeah.
Not go there to an empty room and hope to build over 3 years. You know, use the online technology to build fans before you get there. But be there so that they become super fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you do it enough, and I think Sumo Psycho has toured Europe now like 8 times.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Can't get arrested in Canada, but they can definitely go to Europe and play shows. And what's the singer's name? What's her name?
Sky.
Sky. I remember her when she was like a little teen Avril kind of pop star kind of person. Like when Avril Lavigne was making it big, people were like, we need our Avril. We got to get one. And I actually played in her warm-up band with Mo Berg. And
we
jammed like once or twice with her to get her like sort of up to speed on how to perform live, because Mo was really attached to her in the early days of that. So to be it still goes back to this sort of this idea of like a show now turns into an actual appearance rather than a show, which people are like, well, I can see that anytime. I can go to the Bovine and go watch rock and roll music anytime I want. Maybe I'll see 20% of the bands are going to be awesome. The other 80 are going to suck. At least this way, it's sort of when this band, who I know is a YouTube sensation or whatever, a online sensation, let's say, give them the YouTube, let's take that out of there. But that turns into, oh, I got to go because they're not going to be coming through town for the next year. And then it turns into like, oh, now shows, because they're selective rather than like, let's just blanket play everywhere all the time and saturate everything. Because that's all we knew what to do in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I think the digital part of it is like for instance, with Indie Week, we do ads.
Mm-hmm.
We did some tests 2 years ago, and, you know, like we did ads targeted just directly to South America.
Yeah.
5 minutes after turning it on, I got a phone call from Peru, right? And then I got an email from Colombia. And like they're like, what's this Indie Week stuff?
Yeah.
Right. So we've done some tests and we know it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be expensive. Like we ran an ad earlier this year that cost under $400, but we had 866,000 impressions. And that's a lot of eyeballs getting to know our brand. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's smart ways to do it before going, right? Because then later you get the data and you can see how many people from what country, what cities are actually coming on board. And you can then say, okay, well, now I'm going to run an ad directed just to the top five cities. And let's see if we can triple that audience. Mm-hmm. And then if you can, then you go, well, if we've got, say, logistically 300 to 500 people that are looking at us from those areas, let's book a show that holds 100 people. Right. And we could possibly sell it out without even being there before. Yeah. Right. And then you're capturing data then that you're building a relationship with these people, like after the show, even if it's 12 months before you go back, you can have ads and messaging go to the same people.
Yeah.
And so there are tools that do that, you know, this is a great plug and segue into some of the CD Baby stuff is that there's tools that do that. Show.co is a tool that allows artists to very easily target geographically areas. And, you know, with having an online store, that's where you can capture data of people coming from where, and then you can segment the ads, targeting it back to where you're getting the most traffic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the thing that's really different from when I was touring is there are tools that, like, the artist can completely run their own business, where before you had to try to get a record deal.
Yeah,
you
know? Or have a publicist, or yeah.
Yeah, and I remember talking to some people recently about where, you know, if you had a CD, it was like, wow, something's going on, because recording studios were really expensive, and actually putting out the CD itself was really expensive. So it was kind of like, if you were an artist that had a CD, it was like, whoa, something's going on with you, you know? The tools these days, everybody can just run their own business.
Yeah. Well, I remember then there was the time after that when you get the CD and you turn it over to see if it was green. The back was green. Because there was a certain legitimate, if it was green, that means you copied it yourself. Or if it had one of those...
You
burned it yourself. Or you had a burning service, because there was companies out there would burn you 100 CDs, and they would literally burn you for the cost, where you could... Yeah, yeah, Lacquer Channel, I think, did that. They had a duplication, like a quick run, like just all the CD burners in the room, like hit record and off you go. But
I did that with my computer, you know, that's where it came into, was the CD manufactured or duplicated? Yeah. And the duplicated were the ones that were green, right?
Green or gold, or a weird kind of gold color. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it would play on a PC, but not a Mac, or vice versa.
Yeah. No, it was an audio CD that would play in a CD player, but when they'd stuck those stickers on it, it somehow threw the balance off on it. And also, it was super susceptible to being scratched. And as soon as you scratch that thing, it's like, chuk, 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 do, 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 do. I remember I went out on tour and I made my own. We were opening, my band Foursquare were opening for 10 Foot Pole. So I went out and I made my own CDs with just this acoustic shit that I just thrown together. And I called it Finsky, and I made CDs myself, and I photocopied the thing on red stock, which I think was brilliant, because, like, whoa, if it's photocopied, at least it needs to be on a different color than white. And I sold it at the merch table for like €3 or something, just enough to screw the person up for change. You know what I mean? Like, so they'd buy something, and it was like they'd have $3 change or so, or €3 change. They would like buy the CD. And I was thinking about calling it Smokes Money, because it was money for smokes. but we called it Finsky instead, and it was neat because it had like Jason Tate from Weaker Than's played on two songs. I had Trevor from Treble Charger played on a song. It was just stuff that wasn't my band, you know, but it's stuff I'd recorded along the way. And I, like, the reason I'm saying this is because we had a flood in our basement, and I took all these CDs out, and there was like a stack of them, like the ones I had made one at a time off our old HP computer. I was like, oh my God, I still have these things, you know, and they still play. It's interesting, you know.
Yeah, I've got a whole stack. Like, I was doing a monthly compilation of indie artists, and there was some great music on there, but it was that by being able to burn CDs, like we would actually, well, I would get a company to duplicate them. By doing that, it allowed us to kind of like do the mixtape kind of underground, hand out CDs at shows. And the thing is, the way we would do it is I would get international artists on there. So I had artists from like Germany, from UK, from all over. And we would mail them copies of it. So it was like the Canadian artists on there would be getting oh, wow. passed around in Germany and, you know, really DIY grassroots kind of stuff. But that kind of stuff was really cool, you know, and, you know, sending to the same people a CD every month and like, here's new stuff to check out. You know, that part was cool, which is now today's playlists. Spotify playlists is just exactly that. But I'm getting too many things and it turns into white noise almost.
Yeah, I think I've said it's like this. It's so much noise of information coming to us that it's really tough to filter into compartmentalize it into something that's prioritized, whether it's good or not, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that just isn't that good, but they have the same voice that the really good ones do, especially at that learning, that beginning stage. So like, I'm a really great band and I'm a really, there's a really shitty band and they have the same opportunity, you know, and the same opportunity is brought to them to say, and all the things we were talking about, like discovering analytics and discovering how to advertise and all these things. The problem is that they have the same, you know, launching period.
And I think where this sort of ties into what we were talking about with the live touring kind of stuff. I think a lot of artists now feel that the way to make it is to get on a Spotify playlist, and all that they're trying is the digital side. You know, and like I do go to a lot of these festivals, and what's really sad is that the whole aspect of a band is disappearing. I'll go and I'll be like, wow, I've seen 6 bands but not one guitar yet. I've seen a lot of laptops and looping stations. And you know, when you talk to them, they're like, well, it's just easier to tour. I don't need a drummer. And, well, you know, we don't do as many shows, so it's hard to keep a band together. And, you know, they have all these kind of like reasons to not actually have a band. And I feel that that's affecting the live music side of things, because we're almost training people to not have high expectations.
Yeah. Well, even, you know, it's funny. I worked for Kim Mitchell a few times and he tried to do some shows without a keyboard player. He said, I'll just run tracks. We'll do tracks. And like, he just played whatever, probably 3 weeks ago and there was no tracks. You know what I mean? He learned real fast. Like, you need a keyboard player. You know, his other band had a keyboard player, like this amazing keyboard player. And why are we playing tracks? Why are we doing it a disservice? And, you know, I've seen the same thing where it's a band. There is no drummers. There's 3 people up front and there's like this rack that's playing the tracks, and the music's great and it sounds just like the record, but you still need to kind of switch it out a little bit, even though, you know what I mean? Like there's, I don't know. I saw White Horse and they do stuff that with the 2-piece and they do stuff with the 3-piece, but the 2-piece was like so awesome because it's like reinventing the song every time they do it, even though they were using looping machines and stuff, like they were doing some really cool shit. And that was fun to watch. And that was the only band that, because you'd sit there and play drums and then they'd loop it. And they had this one switch looping machine that would, this was the whole show. And I think even the sound guy was in it somewhere. Somehow he was manipulating the show. That's intelligence, you know, that's using technology to your advantage, you know. And sort of computer-based music having a soul, I don't know if it really is there like it used to be, like when days of Bjork and days of even, you know, name a group from the 90s that did like electric music. The soul seems to need to come back.
I was like at a festival last year, and you know, there's a whole bunch of us delegates and we're like, you have to be at this show, you have to see this artist, right? And it's a buzz artist, they're signed to a record label. In fact, I just got an email 2 weeks ago about their new release and like it's all buzzing, you know. And I think it took an hour for them to set up, and they're supposed to take 20 minutes, you know.
Sounds like Len.
There's only two of them, but I think there was four laptops, six keyboards, and two racks, and I think about 120 cables that needed to be plugged in.
Jesus.
And I was like, they better be able to sing. And 30 seconds in, right, we're like, they can't sing.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a, it was kind of the case where, like, hey, in the basement, they could probably produce it all to make it sound amazing, but they can't do it live.
Yeah.
And that whole, well, it's easier than having a full band wasn't easier, because, like, it took them forever to plug in a gazillion things. And they still sounded, to, in my eyes, like, pretty bad. Like, I think I was like, you know, I was there with a rep from Singapore, and he uses like the same thing. And we're like, okay, well, we'll give a, like, song two a chance. Well, maybe the first one, whatever. But 30 seconds into song two, we were off to another club.
Yeah. No, it's good, because that definitely is, it's amazing to be, oh, it would be very scary to be the duo. It's not a band. It's, let's call it a duo. But it'd be, because to see all these people with their arms folded go and impress me. But if they have like all these machines that are supposed to carry them through the show, you better be able to be do some backflips up there, as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? There better be some juggling, a bit of fire, something
exciting.
Yeah,
but the sad part is because it's turning into, like I said, like I'll go to these conferences or these festivals and I won't see a guitar anywhere or whatever. So because we'd already seen four artists before that artist that are just laptops and keyboards, a lot of people were like, wow, this is amazing. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, the expectations get lowered.
Yeah. And so I'm finding on the festival circuit, there's a lot of artists that do sound the same. And
interesting.
And it's, you know, I come from a time too, where probably I'm old and jaded, but you know, and I've talked to people about this, like, you know, I remember when Rage Against the Machine was launching at the same time Eminem was launching, at the same time Snoop Dogg was launching, at the same time Metallica and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. And we had all of these great innovative artists that sounded very different from each other, whether it be very loud, like even Pantera at the time, you know, really loud to like rap and hip hop was coming up, but same time industrial with Nine Inch Nails. Like there's a lot of innovation going on. And you know, festivals then, you know, the Lollapaloozas was a celebration of diversity in the music. And I'm finding a lot of the festivals are programming. There is some diversity in there for, and sometimes it almost feels it's for the sake to say there's diversity.
Right.
But if you look at the top level artists, a lot are all sounding the same or same genres and things like that. And that too is, I think, conditioning the, you know, the festival goer.
Well, yeah, because you're now tuning in, like you said, talked before about analytics, where a certain amount of demographic, they hate this, but they love that. And the indifference part is the tough part to figure out. So I'm indifferent to a guy with a tuba in the band. I don't know if I'm into that, but I really like it when they have four laptops and a guy with no guitar. I'm really into that. Okay, well, let's book 20 of that, because then we're going to give them everything they want. But what they're not realizing, that the gray area in a festival, like something that completely turns your head, is the magic of the festival. You know, you're going to go there and see your Rage Against Machines or your Blink-182s or whatever, but that stuff in the middle around 6 o'clock, that's always like that juicy stuff they throw in there just to sort of keep your mind from, and that's what programs a great festival as well, is that you can actually, whoever does that can kind of like give you something that you never expect you'd get, hence heightening the brand of the festival.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was invited to a festival in France in December last year, and it's called Trans Musicale. Mm-hmm. This was their 40th year. So they've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
And it's all about emerging artists. Like, it's, you're there to discover. But it was really impressive. Like, they run it in an airport, so there's like hangars like 1 through 10 that hold about 5,000, 10,000 people each.
Yeah,
packed, and nobody knows who these artists are.
Yeah, that's Europe. I love about Europe is people have this appreciation to stuff isn't like the norm, or they want to, they're thirsty for, like, maybe I'm generalizing, I'm totally generalizing, but the people that I've met in Europe are completely into the obscure, and what's weird is great.
Well, this particular festival, they have that reputation. I think it was like the kind of thing like Nirvana played there before they were big, and and you know, they just have this reputation of the programming being excellent, and it's worth the price of admission to discover these bands. So it was great to be at. I really, really appreciated it.
It must be tough being ahead of the curve like that, because there must be a whole team of people who are out fishing and looking for new bands to say, like, and they're curating the content and what's going to happen based on their feeling, you know, rather than analytics, because you have no analytics when you're starting off. Something's so obscure. You have like this much information on the group. And I wonder how many, wonder what the under over ratio of bands breaking up before the festival starts. That's it's like, we book you like 6 months in advance. Like, yeah, we got this gig. And then the drummer gets in a fight and then they quit. And then it turns out to be like, well, we can't play it because our drummer left. He's in this other band though. Check him out.
Yeah, we've had that.
Yeah, bad.
We've had it where, like, we were taking a band to Europe that played our festival, and by the time, like, 2 months or a month after we decided we're taking them to Europe, they're like, "Yeah, we're kicking the singer out." They're like, sorry. "But we're taking it to Europe," and like, "We'll have a new singer by then."
Yeah, sorry, and not interested anymore.
So, but that has happened many times.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. So, well, hey man, CD Baby, go check it out. I it's so funny, 'cause I know it's been around for a long time, right? Like
yeah.
15 like, years, 20 years.
Oh, at least it was late '90s.
Late '90s. So yeah, 20 something years.
Yeah. And it's evolved a lot. Like,
like I said,
we've got all these tools that are there for the artists to use to run their business, whether it be marketing, royalty collection, ad revenue on YouTube. Like, even like when I was like, it was a discovery to me when I went through the training process, because I thought online distribution.
Yeah.
But you know, it's hard to market it, because when you're saying, "Hey, we do this, we just, it would confuse everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what we're doing is, like, I'm for Canada. We've hired a team of individuals like myself in Latin America, Southeast Asia, Mexico, Europe. So we've got people on the ground in different territories. And a lot of it is about just educating artists on how to run their business, you know, and even the point where, you know, we're very confident in that we're providing the best tools for the independent artist, that we don't even do a hard sell. It's just more about the education. And if people do the research, it's like, we've got a lot to offer.
Yeah.
So, and it's great. Like I said, it's great working for a company that has that, vision and the culture of the company itself.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can talk to the head, no problem. Like, I email him the other day and he gets back to me right away. Like, communication is very open, and we're all about sharing ideas and, you know, just giving the best for the independent artists. So I'm very excited, because working on some education programs. I just talked for panels for London Music Office in conjunction with the Junos. Did Music Ontario on Thursday. I'm doing Toronto Blues Society. I spoke at Seneca. So we're really about educating artists, and I don't see other companies doing that. Like, they'll go, "Here's online distribution. Sign up, put your stuff up, and it's there.
Only the strong survive."
That's it.
yeah.
You know, so I'm very excited about it, and you're going to be hopefully seeing and hearing a lot about CD Baby in Canada in the next 2 years.
Cool, man. Thanks for doing the show.
Thank you.
And that was Mr. Daryl Herz. Great episode. Nice long one. We haven't had a nice long one in a while. Lots of awesome stuff to take home and listen to on that podcast. Yeah, great. Always a great conversation with a knowledgeable person who knows what the hell he's talking about. And that's Daryl. So, everybody, thanks so much for listening to the show. Thanks for tuning in every week. Thanks for shopping on Amazon. Thanks for going to Patreon. And really, honestly, thanks for doing this show. There's 225 episodes. I made a plan with myself to do 200, but here I am 25 in, so maybe I'll go to 300. How about that? So, everybody, thanks so much again for listening to the show. I will see you next week. Take care. Bye.